Hello, and welcome to the first episode for 2018 of Hromadske Radio's Ukraine Calling. We've changed our format. Now we'll be bringing you a feature interview with Ukraine's opinion makers, cultural movers and shakers, other interesting people, and the latest in the music from Ukraine. I'm Bohdan Nahailo, and this week I have a great interview lined up for you with one of Ukraine's and Europe's top writers, Andrei Kurkov, who is an ethnic Russian but describes himself as a political Ukrainian, to share with you. And after that, a newly released song to start the new year. Well, this week it's my great pleasure to have in the studio the celebrated writer from Ukraine, perhaps Ukraine's best literary export of our times, Andrei Kurkov. He's exceptional not only by his popularity in the outside world, but I think also because of the civic position that he takes, his principled stance, not extremely overt, but nevertheless in its discreet way, as an example of a writer setting an example to the society in which he finds himself and which he describes. So, Andrei, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much. Hello.
Let's begin by talking about your literary output. You know, personally, I've lost track of how many books you've published, how many novels, and we're not going to go into essays and interviews.
No, I published 21 novels. I didn't publish my first four novels and will never publish it because it was just a beginner's texts, but also published some children's books, about 11, and some children's books are still in store because I lack illustrators to work with. But generally, that's my output.
And is the best-selling one, the best-known one, still your first one that was published?
First translated. Yeah, it was Death and the Penguin in English. But also The President's Last Love was very well received. And my recent English translation is my one of the oldest novels, The Bigfords Fuse, which got very good reviews in Financial Times and Guardian and other editions.
Well, that really is exceptional for a writer from Ukraine. And I emphasize that you're Russian-born. You're a Russian by ethnicity, but I guess a Ukrainian now by adaptation and by choice and by spirit.
Well, I always say that I'm ethnic Russian, political Ukrainian. I grew up in Ukraine. My family moved to Kyiv when I was less than 2 years old. So actually, it's my country. It's my city.
You're a member of a political Ukrainian nation. Yeah. Which is what I hope we're building together in these difficult days. Now, let's just return again to your major works. Death and the Penguin, that was such an unusual theme and approach. How did that come into your head, that, you know, the imagery that you used?
I think this is the result of very specific Soviet upbringing. And my inborn optimism, because I'm still an optimist in spite of all the problems the country faces and has now. But generally, I had been writing this novel in 1995-96, when the situation in the country was quite dire, very dark. And at the same time, lots of writers were writing so-called black novels, which were not given even a hope or tiny specter of hope. So, I mean, they were written by depressed people who hated the subject they wrote about, they hated the country they wrote about, and they hated their characters. I would never do the same. So I was actually trying to describe the situation in the country, which was difficult, the situation, but live in hope and not forgetting about humor, black humor, irony, as some kind of medicine against depression.
Well, it seemed both satirical and surrealistic at the same time, for me at any rate. But by the time you'd got to The President's Last Love, I don't know, I saw shades of Latin American, sort of writers,
García
Márquez and others there, or even Vargas Llosa. Were you influenced by Latin American writers?
I never thought I was influenced, actually. I was influenced by Gogol, Bulgakov, Kvitkos, Novyanenko, Kafka, Camus, and Knut Gamsun. I was never
Had a hunger for these things.
Yes, exactly. I was never actually so crazy about Latin American literature. I liked Borges, but not more than liked. but probably maybe on the subconscious level. I mean, I could be influenced by everything I read, of course.
But who else influenced you? Were you influenced by, you know, English? So were you reading English authors as well?
I did read in English, in French, in also in Polish and in German.
A Renaissance man, born and bred in Soviet times.
But when I wrote The President's Last Love, actually, I tried to create 3D picture of human life from sort of 1970s till the future. At that time, future for me was 2017. Actually, this is the year the novel ends, and the novel was published in 2004.
Amazing. Like for many of us, 1984, we couldn't wait for that year to come with trepidation. And then it came, and now we're in 2017, as you say. So how have your works developed? Has the range of your interests shifted to any specific area, or are you still sort of choosy and ad hoc about what turns up?
I mean, I get impulses from life. For example, I mean, I have a novel which is called in English The Good Angel of Death, or Kind Angel of Death. It was written in 1997 after my many discussions with Ukrainian nationalists about the role of Ukrainian language in the society and about possible or not possible assimilation, linguistic assimilation of the linguistic minorities of the country. So the novel in original is bilingual because there are characters speaking Ukrainian in the novel and characters speaking Russian. And my latest novel, which I have finished now, but I'm still editing, it's called The Grey Bees. And it is about Grey Zone, Donbass and Crimea, about today's situation in Ukraine. So, of course, I'm influenced by what is happening because, I mean, the situation...
So you're on the cutting edge. You're still staying up with current affairs,
issues.
Yeah,
I mean, this is a writer's role. If he is not a science fiction writer, he has to be in reality. And I mean, writing a novel like this allows you to live in two realities at the same time. Your personal reality, which can be detached from the war, detached from the politics, and your second reality, which you are filling with what you lack in first reality.
But how hard is it to be truly honest, writing about such sensitive subjects here in this context of Ukraine, yet having publishers that want to promote the book outside of Ukraine? How do you balance your honesty with what the market expects from you?
I had already a situation when I had been writing a book, The Gardens of Mr. Maturin, knowing that this book will not be translated, will not have a lot of readers, but I needed to write it. So I've done it. Almost nobody knows about this novel. There was only one edition in Russian, and that's all. So, I mean, this time I'm not thinking about the publishers. I'm thinking about the situation I'm describing. I'm thinking about the local readers. And if the book will be taken by the publishers abroad, I think it will give them also the information. The honesty is subjective. I mean, I'm trying to be objective in this actually story. I went to the zone of the war two times. I know a lot of refugees. I talk to soldiers. I talk to people who don't want to talk to anybody in Severodonetsk, for example, actually. And the main character is like this. There is no fantasy there, except for the plot which I developed, which is slightly surreal sometimes, but very realistic because everything which is described in the novel is possible.
Of course. Now tell us, where are your books most popular? Where are they selling best or most read?
Well, it's German-speaking countries, French-speaking countries, in English translation and in Japanese. And now, actually, I feel that I'm more and more read in Italy, for example, and more in Arab world. I have a new book in Arabic language in Egypt, and I'm invited now to Dubai for March to have events, public events.
And you must obviously give a lot of interviews and are asked for your comments here and there, so that probably cuts into your writing time.
It does. And
you travel a lot.
I travel 5-6 months a year. And most of the interviews which I gave abroad are not about my books, about Ukraine, about political situation, about the prospects of the relationship with Russia, etc. So I became sort of an expert on Ukraine after 2001. actually, after Gongadze case.
Yeah, well, you've become a foremost cultural emissary, but also a political commentator and observer. But tell us, what's your typical working day when you're not traveling? How many hours on a good day do you actually put into writing?
Well, it depends whether I am in the beginning or at the end of the novel. Because when I'm at the beginning of the novel, I spend more time thinking and making notes than writing, and then I can write for 3 or 4 hours. But when I'm already in the process of writing the novel, I mean, the working day of writing can take up to 14 hours. I mean, when I had been finishing The Garden of Ochakov, novel, I had been writing 12-14 hours every day. Now I'm writing about sort of 5-6-7 hours if I'm not traveling. If I'm traveling, sometimes I'm writing the same amount of time, but I'm writing on the planes, on the
and you're
trains.
Writing on a laptop, or are you writing in longhand with a pen?
The actual text I write on the laptop, and the notes I take on the pad, writing pad. And actually, sometimes when the battery is flat, I start writing also with my hand.
Well, tell us a little bit about your own personal tastes. I mean, of writers that you respect, read these days, who are among your favorites?
Among Ukrainian writers, probably Yurko Vinichuk. For me, he is one of the biggest, actually, most important writers, novelists in Ukraine. I like very much novels by Maria Matios. And if we are talking about foreign literature, I started reading more and more non-fiction than fiction. And last 5 years, I'm following the works of Martin Pollack, Austrian professor of history and writer, who discovered for me another different Ukraine, different Galicia, because the first book I read is called Kaiser of America. It's history of emigration from Bukovina and Galicia in the mid-19th century, and it turned my understanding of this history upside down, because it's completely different thing what we used to believe. And so I'm reading more and more of his books now, The Last Train Journeys in Bukovina and Galicia, last book which was translated in Chernovtsi into Ukrainian.
Yeah, that's one of the ironies and the tragedies that, you know, for Ukrainians, their history had so many blank spots, and they've been trying to recover much of this cultural and historical memory. And yet the presence of the Jews, the Russians, the Poles and others was also blotted out. And it's only now that writers like Bruno Schulz are being rediscovered and translated, or others. And the Jewish heritage in Western Ukraine, for example, exactly. Particularly where you say in Chernivtsi and in Lviv.
Exactly. And I mean, we are having new, actually, black holes in Ukrainian literature now, because the Crimean Tatar writers were and are ignored until today. There are no translations of their novels or collections of poetry. The Ukrainians got recently very angry with Hungarians, but since 1991, no Hungarian-Ukrainian writer was translated into Ukrainian. Until 1991, they were translated into Russian and Ukrainian, always. Now we have about 30-40 active writers living in Ukrainian Transcarpathian region, completely ignored, even in Uzhgorod, because, I mean, when I took my friends, writers from Uzhgorod to Beregovo and Vinogradiv, they were amazed to see that there is a literary magazine in Hungarian written by Ukrainian citizens, Ukrainian writers. There are literary projects, and there are many young writers who write in Hungarian, living in Ukraine, writing about their region, about Ukraine, helped by Hungarian mainland publishers or institutions, but helped like smaller brothers who cannot walk properly.
So what you're saying is that Ukrainians, as the majority nation here, should not simply be preoccupied with this victim image of themselves, but should also see in their role as the strongest ethnic group, how they can help others and support them.
They should show that they are uniting minorities around themselves. And they, I mean, like British Council or other institutions, when they are bringing their authors to Ukraine, for example, look at the ethnicity of these authors. One of the British writers who was sent by Britain to Ukraine was Tobias Fischer, the Hungarian who moved to England 20 or 30 years ago, who is now an English writer. And they are proud to show him as an English writer. We should be proud to show our writers of not Ukrainian ethnicity as Ukrainian writers.
Right. And you obviously set a very good example of this cultural tolerance in this sphere, because we've said you're from a Russian background, you're an ethnic Russian, yet you speak fluent Ukrainian. You do not distance yourself from Ukraine. As I said, you've become a leading representative of the modern tolerant Ukraine, this democratic Ukraine that we're building. Now, tell us a little bit about your role and involvement in the Ukrainian PEN Center.
Well, I'm vice president of the PEN. The president of the PEN is Mykola Repchuk. We have about 30-40 active people, and we managed this year to host International PEN Congress, first time actually on Ukrainian territory, having received more than 150 delegates from lots of countries. And it was a success for which we have to pay now, because everybody expects in International PEN that we will be one of the leading PEN centers in Central Europe.
Yes, I'm talking to Andrei Kurkov, the celebrated writer, resident in Ukraine, and perhaps even better known in the outside world than among many Ukrainians here, unfortunately, I would say. Though we do have a reading public, particularly among the young people that are increasingly more interested in reading your works and works in Ukrainian and in Russian. But the International PEN Center, PEN, for those who maybe are not aware, an international writers organization, poets, essayists, novelists to defend freedom of speech and writers who find themselves in trouble with the authorities.
Well, actually, it's more like a political literary organization which fights for human rights and which fights actually for the writers and journalists who are persecuted or are in prisons. And it is very influential because we managed as an international PEN to get freedom for Esli Erdogan, Turkish writer who lives in Germany. When she came to Turkey, she was arrested, and even her passport was returned to her. But I mean, we have the situations in many countries which is very difficult and needs attention, international attention.
Well, you know, this is of great interest to me, because when I was still a student and postgraduate at the London School of Economics, my first job was with Amnesty International, but I was very closely aligned then with the PEN, International PEN Center, and Mario Vargas Llosa was the president. And at that time, it was a major achievement for us to get Stu, Svitlichny, Sverstyuk, Chornovil, Osachi, and other Ukrainian writers recognized by the PEN. It meant a lot, and it still does.
You know, I was not a writer at all in 1988. I was not published, but I was invited to become a member of English PEN, and my first English translation and publication was in the Amnesty International magazine Index on Censorship.
That's where I started. My first publication was about Ivan Svitlichny in 1980. And the second one was about Ihor Kalinets, Index on Censorship. At that time, the late George Theiner was the deputy editor. He was a Czech. And Michael Skamel, who wrote the definitive biography of Solzhenitsyn, was the editor. Those were very interesting days. Andrei, what are you working on at present? We're now coming to the end of our
discussion. Yeah, I'm editing the new novel, which I mentioned already, The Grey Bees, about this grey zone annexed Crimea and Donbass and Ukraine. And I'm thinking about next projects, which will be mostly actually projects organized together with PEN Ukraine and maybe PEN New York to help young Ukrainian writers to lead public discussions on any topic. I had done two projects like this last year in Transcarpathian region and in Odessa region, and we got involved about 25-30 young writers from all around Ukraine, and we can repeat now in other areas of Ukraine, including also Donbass, Ukrainian-controlled territory of Donbass, and Bukovina and Slobozhanshchina.
Okay, two final questions from me. Which of your books, of your many books, novels, is the most satisfactory for you? Which one do you feel is your best work, for you personally, not in terms of sales?
Yeah, I mentioned already The Bigfoot Fuse, which was published first time, self-published in 1993, but now is published in German and in English. And among the recent ones, I'm very happy with Schengen Story. It's called Schengen Story, but it will be probably in French and other languages called Paris, London, Anikščiai, because it's about Lithuanians living for Europe after Western Europe, after Lithuania already became a member of European Union.
And is it a sort of caveat emptor to those who see Europe as the great paradise that beckons?
Yeah, it is, but it is a big novel, and it shows not only the situation in Lithuania, but also life in France and life in England. So it's a big European novel, 800 pages, with four plot lines, and with no bits of unknown Lithuanian history and unknown European history.
Well, Andrei, you know, everywhere you go, you're asked to comment about the situation in Ukraine, your take and what's happening. So in a few sentences, how do you read? Where do we stand? You know, here we are a few years after the revolution of dignity, the Maidan that you described. Are we moving forward? Are we stagnating? Are you hopeful? Are you pessimistic?
I'm hopeful. I'm a grey optimist. I was a black optimist in 1993 when it was really black situation. I feel that the batteries are slightly flat in Ukrainian politics, and that the movement towards reforms and reforming the country slowed down, and the government and the political elite needs a push. But it doesn't need new Maidan, it doesn't need riots, it doesn't need pogroms. It needs push, and it needs to get into real political activity, because what we have as a political activity in the country, very often fake. We have 300 political parties. We don't have daily political activities of ordinary members. We don't have offices of parties in the towns, cities and villages. We have only so-called paid activists who are active only before the election. So we have to change this system. And once we will understand that every party has ideology, and if I am a liberal, I want to join Liberal Party, and I am sure that the Liberal Party will defend liberal values. In this situation, I mean, the political, I think, society will become much more civilized, and we won't have riots, Maidans and pogroms, because there will be no place for them. If you are active, you can be active legally, politically, and on the civilized level.
Okay, and as a footnote, I should have asked you this earlier, but it intrigues me to hear from you, your Russian colleagues and friends in Russia and outside. How do they view you? They probably rate you very highly as a writer, but are they easy, comfortable with your identification with Ukraine?
Well, I mean, my friends and colleagues, there are not many of them, actually, with whom I keep in touch, but they are on my side in both cases, in as my political statements and my writers. I'm talking about Vladimir Sorokin, Lyudmila Ulitskaya, Boris Akunin, and Tatiana Shcherbina, who lives in Moscow, some others, yeah. But officially for Russia, I'm a traitor, and I'm a foreign writer. And as I found out yesterday from the interview given in Kyiv by Dmitry Bykov, I'm a French writer living in France and not Ukrainian writer. So, I mean, there are lots of myths, but my books are not available in Russia, so I don't think anybody talks about me anymore, because I am not present there as a writer.
But you're present, and you will be present for decades to come. I want to thank you, Andrei Kurkov, for agreeing to this interview, and to wish you all the very best, lots of creative and literary success in the years to come.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Moving on to music, piano. It's a musical instrument, a musical term for soft, and the name of a musical group in Lviv. The Lviv Piano just released a single from their upcoming album, and it premiered on Hromadske Radio's morning show this week. Thought you might enjoy it. It's called Nizhnost, which means tenderness, which sounds about right for all of you celebrating Christmas right now, according to the old calendar.
Боже, поговори зі мною. мене немає зброї, немає зброї. Боже, як мені бути з собою, коли темні приходять нуді. Боже, як мені бути з тобою, коли вічність така мала. Боже, в мене немає зброї, в мене немає зброї, лише слова. І я стою за плечима небо, і Боже, як треба, ти дай мені сили. І я стою за плечима небо, і Боже, як треба, ти дай мені сили. Боже, поговори зі мною, у мене немає зброї, немає зброї. Боже, як мені бути з собою, коли відчай приходить мій день. Боже, як мені бути
looking forward. Tune in next week for a new episode and let us know what you think about the new format on Ukraine Calling, one word, at hromadskeradio.org. I'm Bohdan Nahailo for Hromadske Radio in Kiev. Thanks for listening, and Veselik Sviat I Shchaslivoho Novoho Roku, Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year from our team.